Good morning. Thanks for being on time.
You're welcome.
So one of the hallmarks of Trungpa Rinpoche was his attention to detail and doing a thorough job. One time when I was at the what's called the Vajradhatu Seminary, which was a three-month training program, and this particular time it was happening at Lake Louise in Alberta. One of his attendants, I was on duty in his residence there, and one of his attendants brought me a lighter of his and said, Rinpoche would like you to clean his lighter. And it was a very beautiful lighter. It was a lapis lazuli covered, and that's a rare blue stone and gem. Anyway, I looked at it, and it looked pretty clean to me. And I opened it up, and there appeared to be a little bit of black or carbon on the inside. So I cleaned it up. It took me about 5 minutes, and I sent it back. 5 minutes later, it came back and said, Rinpoche would like you to clean his lighter. And I said, okay. I really can't see much more. So I really cleaned it this time, sent it back. It came back 5 minutes later. Rinpoche would like you to clean his lighter. And after the third time of cleaning, and I actually started to begin to see that with each cleaning, there was more that you could see. And so he wanted a thorough job. And while, I had some resistance to doing that, we often do, there's something very satisfying about a thorough job. So in terms of this introduction to the meditation we do here, we're going to do a very thorough job this morning, as many aspects of it as we can cover. So the first thing is the kind of meditation that we're going to be doing here is called shamatha, which is a Sanskrit word, ancient Indian language, Sanskrit. Shamatha means development of peace. It is also known as mindfulness practice, also sometimes called satipatthana in another Indian language, Pali. Also sometimes known as mindfulness awareness practice. So it goes by all of these kinds of names. There are variations. People teach it slightly differently, but there is more continuity than there is variation. So the basic approach is what the Buddha originally taught, and the point of mindfulness practice. Can anybody say what they think the point of doing mindfulness practice might be? Anybody want to suggest that or take a stab at it? Adam? I can, for the time being, I can repeat what he said.
To develop mindfulness.
The idea of mindfulness, well, that's a very deep Buddhist answer. It's also traditionally what we call circular reasoning. I'm trying to develop mindfulness in order to develop mindfulness, which is cool. But why would you want to develop mindfulness? I mean, why else? Okay, cool, that's fine. Anyone else?
Yeah. To realize that you're thinking?
To realize that you're thinking. Yeah, I think that's... I mean, you sort of already know you're thinking, though, right?
But it's more like... Well, when you're practicing, you try not to think, but you can't stop thinking. So you're realizing that you can't stop thinking. And isn't that part of it?
Mm-hmm.
You're more aware, and you know you don't, like, run into many things or, like, lose some stuff?
Yeah, the... well, the more aware... the first part of that you're really saying, it's really to be more mindful, which is kind of immediate sense of what's happening and what's happening next. Awareness is broader and deeper, so that mindfulness can actually take you into awareness. The fact that you don't bump into things is kind of maybe a byproduct.
Still pretty good.
I don't know how I feel about that, because I still bump into an awful lot of things. But yeah, I know it. The name development of peace, shamatha, implies that. We have some agitation that we're working with, and I think that's what you were talking about, Peter?
Yeah.
All right. That if you notice your thinking, you can see that we have this quality of agitated thinking that keeps driving us and maybe drives us to bump into things, so to speak. So the one of the motivations for doing shamatha practice is to discover some actual peace. Also, you know, usually we have some kind of project in mind, something we're about to do or something we're doing, something we're focused on. You know, we want to eat or make some food or go to class or go out and party or go get a latte or whatever it is. We always have some kind of project. With meditation practice, we don't have a project. This is the one time when you don't have a project. And it's interesting what happens when you don't have a project. You start to have projects. That's what you were saying, and you notice that. So it's often said this is an opportunity to do nothing and then to experience the quality of your mind when you're doing nothing. Ultimately, we can discover that the mind is actually peaceful to begin with. We don't have to calm it down. It's actually naturally calm. So that's something about the motivation. So let's just dive right into the practice. So the first part of the practice is taking your seat. It's about the body. So... When you come into the meditation hall, the idea isn't, okay, now I'm going to jump right into meditating. The first thing to do is, since you're going to spend a little bit of time in there, get yourself a good seat and make sure that the cushion you have is appropriate for your body. So when you first sit down, you want to... In the style of sitting that we tend to do here, you want to sit basically in the middle of your cushion. Okay? So that's the first thing, your seat. If you're sitting in this style and you're too far forward, it's like you're perching. So there's a feeling of anticipation. And if you're too far back, it's kind of like laid back. like a lowrider kind of quality, which I see a couple of you have. So you want to try to get into the center, and now your legs are simply crossed in front of you like this. Now, if your legs are, if your knees are higher than your waist, it's going to be uncomfortable for you. And that means you're going to tend to need a higher or a firmer cushion. The real squishy cushions don't tend to work over a long period of time. So ideally you want your legs to be going down a little bit. What's your name?
Wyndham.
You don't have an ideal situation there because with you're quite long-legged, and that's a squishy cushion. So after a while, if you're sitting 20 minutes or a half an hour, you're going to start feeling different kinds of pains because this just isn't a comfortable spot to be in.
This one's a lot firmer. I can just like switch it up.
Yeah, you can, and you can, you know, over time you can try to figure out a good cushion that works for you. All right, so now if you're going to sit, it's good to have a period of time that you're going to sit for and sit for that period of time rather than say, okay, I'm going to sit and then when I kind of don't feel like it anymore, I'm going to stop. Or I'm going to sit as long as I can deal with it, and then I'll get up and go. Because that kind of gets in the way of that idea of not having a project. So when we have a formal sitting situation like this, it's part of the tradition to set it up so that the meditators have the fewest possible concerns. So we have a person in front who takes care of the time. When I hit the gong, that's the beginning. And when I hit the gong again, that's the end. So you don't have to worry about the time. And we generally tell you in advance roughly how long we're going to be sitting. When we have the right kind of staff, we have a hall keeper, or in Tibetan we call it a gekko, who's a person generally at the side of the room. They're kind of trying to look after the temperature of the room and the light, and also eventually after you're sitting for a while, they'll come around because you might be, and they walk around and that kind of wakes you up a little bit, and then they can also look at your posture. Now, in the Zen tradition, they're very tough about this. They whack you with a stick. It's interesting. That is often misunderstood. The whacking with a stick, you actually request it because sometimes if you have a pain in your back, you're probably too young to have pains in your back, but if somebody gives you a good sharp hit, so that's what that's about. But we don't use the stick, so you don't have to worry about that. So you have the gecko taking care of that situation, so you don't have to think, should I get up and open the window, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of the temperature in a room, you have to adjust it. So if you're somebody who gets cold, you should, you know, have a wrap or something like that. Because, you know, we can never satisfy everybody completely. Also, traditionally, around your meditation seat, it's not good to have a bunch of your personal crap. If you have something you're drinking, so you could have one drink there, put it in a particular spot. If you have extra clothing that you might need, have it kind of folded neatly at the side. So there's kind of a tidiness to the area. Because when you have your personal crap around, it makes it into a little nest of your personal stuff. So we actually kind of have a we put stuff over to the side or something like that. There's also outside of the door, there's a gatekeeper so that people aren't just passing in and out of the room, right? So all of this is part of the environment that you begin the sitting practice with, and it's quite important because you'd like to be able to hang out in the space for a while, right? So it's helpful to have that set up and taken care of. So let's get back to the posture. So you have your seat in the middle and your legs. So in terms of your upper body or your torso, we'd like that to be straight, but not stiff. So upright. And sometimes we say it's as if there's a thread from the top of your head that's being pulled up from above. And your spine has a kind of a natural question mark, kind of a shape to it. It's not stiff like that. Now, one way to get there that actually Trungpa Rinpoche taught us was you can start out, everybody do this, just flop down. It was totally flopped. And then from the middle of your chest, lift that up. Just lift that up and let your head and your shoulders fall naturally into place. Because they will. If you lift from that spot, they'll fall naturally into place. And things will stack up almost like you're stacking building blocks or something. So then you have to do something with your hands. So just set them about there. Again, if they're too far forward, that has one kind of feeling, or too far back, another. So your upper arms are parallel to your torso. There are meditation styles where you bring your hands together like that. I'm sure you've seen that. Maybe some of you have done that. We don't use that particular method here. This is just a simpler, more straightforward approach. There's nothing wrong with this, but this is what we do here. So in terms of your eyes, they're open in this practice and cast slightly down. The traditional analogy is you have an ox plow and that you're behind and you're looking down the end of the ox plow. Have any of you done that? Okay, so it's about...
How about lawnmower?
Lawnmower. I doubt that too. I don't know. Yeah, lawnmower works. Actually, I never thought about that. Lawnmower is pretty good. Get your hands down here. You're driving your lawnmower. 6 feet for you Americans. Roughly 2 meters out like that. Now, that gaze can change later on. You can work with that. But the basic gaze is out and slightly down. Now, the last detail of the body we work with is the mouth, which can be, if you like, it can be slightly open. And to facilitate breathing, you can also put your tongue, if you want to, behind the your upper teeth. Any questions about posture? So let's just sit for a couple minutes just with the basic posture. All right. So that has a quality of meditation in itself. Taking a good, upright posture and just maintaining that posture. Sometimes it's said you're like a king or a queen sitting on the throne, and surveying your world in that way. So there's a quality of dignity and command and peacefulness about that. Or you're like a rider on a horse, and you have a good seat in the saddle. So oftentimes we can get into the habit of blowing past that. Got to get to the meditation. Got to get to the meditation thing. But it's been, Trungpa Rinpoche said, meditation is a noun, not a verb. It's not something you're doing. I got to get to do this. So it's always good to start with establishing a good seat and posture. There's a quality of that. Suzuki Roshi also said it's the thoughts have a different kind of quality when you take that kind of seat. They said they're flat. So it's not as easy to become agitated, so to speak. So, nevertheless, do you feel the need to have a little bit of focus? Because if you're just sitting in the posture, there's also the possibility of just kind of spacing out. So it's helpful to have some kind of immediate object of mindfulness to work with. Some traditions use an external object, like a flame or a stone or something like that. The most common, what we do in this tradition for the most part, is to work with our breath, because it's the absolutely simplest thing that you could pay attention to. If you're alive, you're breathing. In fact, that's pretty much the signal that you're not alive. So if you're not breathing anymore, you'll know that you're dead. So that's the first thing we could choose. The Buddha was a very simple guy in some ways. Okay, we're going to sit on the ground. Hey, we're just going to take hold of the next thing that comes along. Oh, there, I'm breathing. So the very simplest project you could have is to pay attention to the next breath. We're not doing breathing exercises, though. That's a separate kind of discipline, doing breathing exercises. In this case, we're working with whatever breath we happen to have. So, you don't. If you're agitated and upset, if you have a lousy boss and he's been yelling at you all week and it's on your mind, you may be agitated. You have that particular quality of your breath. You don't try to do anything with it. You just work with that breath. In this case, we work with the out breath. We sometimes say, follow the out breath or pay attention to the out breath. And the kind of attention we're paying to the out breath is what we call bare attention. It's the same kind of attention you'd have if you were picking something up. Like, let's say I had a glass of water here. I have this clock. So I don't just say, I'm going to pick up the clock with really intense focus. Or, I'm going to pick up this striker. Yeah. It's something you reach for. And so we're able to do those kinds of things all day long. We work with just bare attention. There it is. So you notice the out-breath as it goes out. And then obviously there's going to be a little bit of space when the in-breath is happening. You just let that be there. And then pay attention to the next out-breath. And that's the basic practice. That's it. You take the posture and you follow the out-breath as it comes out. Any questions about that? It's all clear? All right, good. So let's do that for a couple of minutes. Use the gong to signal the beginning and the end. Followed every out breath. What do you notice when you're trying to follow the out breath? Can you follow it every time? You get every single one? So what happens? Anybody? What? How would you describe it? What happens?
You get distracted.
Stories.
Yeah, follow that out.
What's that? No, again, Peter, I'm sorry.
I said, sometimes I think, follow that out.
I'm right.
I'm thinking about it.
Julia?
I just
said thank you. So, we notice that we're thinking. So, what are you thinking about?
The future.
Future. That's one possibility.
Movie.
You can make up your own movie in your mind. Songs, food.
That's all I do.
What's that?
Food is all I do.
Food, just food all the time. I can't relate to that at all. I don't know what you're talking about. So you have something like this. Out-breath. Out breath, hamburger, hamburger, hamburger. Yes. So, did you bring me a hamburger? That's another tradition where you wish for the hamburger and then you get it. They call that the secret. It's never worked for me, but. So, the secret here is a little different from that. When we notice that we're thinking, we have another technique we can use. We label that thinking. We actually say in our mind, thinking, and come back to the next out-breath. So, when we're saying thinking, we're not rejecting it as thinking. Thinking, bad. Or we're not embracing it as thinking. My thinking. Love that thinking. But I had to say goodbye to it for a little while. It's just the same as the bare attention that we're actually very, very good at. As I was saying, you can reach for things. You use bare attention all the time. And it's the same here, thinking. And that moment of saying thinking can actually propel you to the next out-breath. So it's actually, Rinpoche said, that's actually the moment of meditation. That point of noticing is the moment of meditation. Meditation isn't this big project. I am meditating to get better. It's this moment where very definite. Now, we could be sitting here and go off into a big, long storyline, like Amelia was talking about. Have you ever, like, you're mad at somebody, you've ever rehearsed what you're going to say to them? Right? You get this whole thing about, you know, man, I'm a, you know, you asshole. You realize every time you... And of course, half the time you never, you know, when you run into the person, it never works out that way. But you can, you know, you can work it up quite a bit. You can play out a whole movie in your mind. So you could go for 20 minutes and you're kind of slumped over like this, deeply thinking. And then you notice, and at that point, you just say thinking and you come back to the out-breath. So you don't need to entertain the messenger. Like, the message comes, you know, to say, oh, wow, man, I was thinking and I shouldn't have been. That's bad. What a drag. I'm always doing this thinking. Well, there you are again. So you notice that, notice thinking, and you come back to the out-breath. Any questions about the practice of labeling thinking and the practice altogether? Because now we're going to practice for about 10 minutes. So we'll begin with the gong and then end with the gong. Just a little bit about body agitation. So, it's natural to feel energy and some agitation in your body. And if that's happening and you're feeling kind of squirmy, you can ride it a little bit. But if you become actually uncomfortable, you can just take a moment and put your legs out like that and then reestablish the posture and then start again. So just a couple more things. First of all, does anyone have any questions at this point? Yeah.
I have heard the term identifying with the out-breath, and that seems like a difference to noticing it in a way and focusing on it. I said I've heard the term identifying with the out-breath. And just, is there a difference there? Or is that kind of implied in... Because I've just, like, in Shambhala training, I hear different teachers say different things, and sometimes, I don't know. I just don't know what...
Yeah, well, the reason for that is that all of these words and descriptions are trying to hint at an approach and experience. So, focus on, follow... pay attention to, watch, identify with, they all have kind of different suggestions of what that's about. Now, I find the simplest place to start is bare attention, that you're just noticing it. Now, over time, it may become almost a quality of that's all there is, so you're completely identified with it. So maybe there's less Barry and more just this out-breath. But I think if you try really hard to identify with it, I think that would be a bit of a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And trying to be the out-breath. So all of those words are just suggestive of a basic experience. Sometimes we would say something like that to counteract the notion that it's something happening out there and I'm just watching it. I'm back here watching that.
Mm-hmm.
So follow is pretty good. And if you follow it, it actually, you get out and then there's some space out there a bit. We say touch as well. You can touch and then go. Touch, go. Good question. That's great. Okay, anything else? So, I want to say a little bit about the gong. When we start at the beginning of the first session of the day, the gong is rung three times. And when you first come in, you would establish your seat, like I was talking about, and then when the gong rings, it's not like out-breath. Right on top of it is actually, you can use the reverb in the gong as kind of as a transition. So that now I'm making a transition from where I was to out-breath. So that's why the gong is helpful in that way. The same thing goes, why you'll notice at the end of a session, often, if you have a good timer, it's not just, okay, now I'm going to get up and split. It's a little more graceful. So you've been sitting, and then, okay, that's the, when you first hear it, that's the signal that it's ending. You kind of catch the next out-breath. And then as it dies out, then we're going to get up. If we had had another point about the environment, if we had had a timer, a gatekeeper, the gatekeeper would have gone into the kitchen and asked the folks to quiet down. It's not that we're particularly concerned about distractions. We can notice them and come back to the out-breath, but we try to create an environment where we minimize unnecessary distractions. Like after a while, you just have a natural feeling like you want to hear what they're talking about. You know, what's going on out there? It becomes a preoccupation. Yes?
That's something that confuses me because I always hear, like, I don't know how to explain it, but like that distractions and pain and pleasure are almost experiencing them and then letting go is good news.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would we be trying to eliminate distractions? Isn't that kind of like avoidance?
Mm-hmm. In the practice, formal practice, like we're doing here, is developing our mindfulness awareness, or we could also say discovering our innate mindfulness awareness, which can include all activities and distractions, whatever's going on. And we can sometimes say that those, like noticing your thinking, or sometimes if you're sitting and you fall over like this, you jerk back up, you have this kind of sudden jerk, those can wake you up, so to speak. So it's true that so-called distractions, things like that, can wake you up. But we're also trying to cultivate our mindfulness awareness so we don't start out by going to the farmer's market and doing meditation in the middle of the farmer's market. That's why yogis meditated in caves, for example. So we do have a situation where we try to create a container where the opportunities to become distracted are minimal. We're not trying to avoid them. Then we're continually left with ourselves. Then we go out and start to work with the distractions. Does that make sense? So it's very different from avoiding them.
So it's just different steps, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And certainly it can, you know, that's a thing that can happen in meditating. You can get into kind of a trap of, I need my meditation to keep my peace, you know. Get away, world. You know, I need my meditation thing. But that's one of the reasons we keep our eyes open, for example. And we have more than enough stimulus right around us. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Good question. William.
What's the difference between meditating by yourself and meditating with people, if there is a difference?
Yeah, that's a great question. Both of them have their own benefits. Meditating with other people gives us a lot of support and a feeling that, just in my experience, that this isn't something the special that I'm going through. You know, you can almost feel in the room that everybody is kind of experiencing fundamentally the same thing. Because that's one of the things we always fight with. It's like my special problem. Like, I am screwed up. Everybody else is fine. Or occasionally we flip that. Everybody else is screwed up and I'm fine. In this situation, when you practice together, you can feel that it's not quite so special, which is a huge relief. Does that make sense? Do you feel that way in practicing with other people?
Yeah, it does feel different.
Then practicing on your own has a quality of, I can be fine by myself. That's actually one of the first steps in meditation is self-sufficiency. I'm fine on my own. I can just sit here. I don't need any support. I think other things about meditation we can bring up in the context of the discussion group. We got a little late start, so I'm mindful of wanting to do the last part of this and then get on to the next thing. So this is pretty much for the basics. The last thing is that we have periods of walking meditation. So the gong will ring twice. Now, if things are really set up well, the timer never has to speak. The timer doesn't have to say walking meditation. You just, actually, this is something Trungpa Rinpoche said, the joke about human beings is that they don't have to talk to each other. There's an awful lot we can accomplish without babbling about it. So when it rings twice and it's obviously not time for lunch, then it's time to walk. That's all that's going to be happening. At the walking meditation, well, first of all, everybody gets up and then we walk in a circle around the room. And I'm going to ask Carolyn to illustrate this. You just leap up from your cushion. Like there is a hand posture we do here, a mudra. So you take your left hand and you curl your thumb in and you wrap your fingers around it and you put it down here, just above, around your, what they call your hara, just kind of above the waist. And then you wrap your right hand around it, just like you're putting a wrapping on it, and drop the thumb into the space that's there. And, yeah, great, that's it. That's the deal. So, and you walk just as Carolyn is doing it, a slow but not funereal pace. And as all the people are walking together, you try to have a pace that works so that you can adjust. And this is part of practicing together. You actually begin to notice how you can work together with other people quite effectively. And it helps us to learn silently how to cooperate and work together. In Zen monasteries, for example, everybody starts eating and finishes eating at the same time, the entire group, right? Because they have that kind of group awareness going on. So when we're doing the walking, it's kind of like that. Okay, so let's go ahead and do the walking.
You are listening to Dharma Classes on Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Tune in next week for Class 3 of the Essential Chogyam Trungpa series. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listeners. To contribute, visit chroniclesradio.com, where you can make a donation in dollars, euros, or pounds. To bring this episode to a close, here is Heather Marie Phillip singing Clear Blue Sky, which was written for Trungpa Rinpoche and features on her CD, Under the Apple, with trumpet work by Brad Upton.
Special, no disguise. at me, stretching far as the eye can see. What you want is what will be when what you want is what you need. Beautiful, you are so free, deeper than the widest sea. Choke it, that's the way to me. You're the clear blue sky in front of me.